This is The Source on KSTX 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Dozens murdered, maybe many, many more, including children. One child axed to pieces in front of the child's parents. These aren't acts of terror of ISIS. This is how the Zetas do business right across the border. This week in federal court, a jury convicted a Zeta lieutenant, Marciano Milan Vasquez, of multiple murders, kidnappings, drug running, and more. The witnesses described crimes in horrifying detail that seemed too over the top to be real, but they are real. We're going to spend the next hour talking about the trial, what we learned, and what the future looks like for the Zetas and drug trafficking in Mexico. We invite you to call into the conversation. If you've got questions or comments, the number is 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet us at @tprsource. We're joined by two San Antonio Express News reporters who are covering the federal trial of Milan Vasquez. Jason Book, he's a staff reporter for the Express News, and Guillermo Contreras, he is the senior reporter there. And welcome to The Source, both of y'all.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us.
Guillermo, Marciano Milan Vasquez, he was arrested in San Antonio, and they told this story that he was actually a Zeta high-ranking official and responsible for incredible, horrifying murders and other acts there. And he was convicted for it. So we're just going to assume, you know, he this is who he was. But the defense first said that he was actually just an innocent rancher who fled Mexico because of the violence. I mean, so how convincing? I mean, obviously, the defense, they didn't have a convincing argument, but it seems like an incredible story. What did you think of this whole thing?
Well, I mean, it was kind of two parts. You know, they cast him as a rancher who ran a store in Piedras Negras that sold, like, foodstuffs kind of thing. And that the military there in Mexico picked him up, and then they tried to accuse him of certain things, of running guns or what have you, and he eventually was that he was acquitted there, and then the defense lawyer says he in fear for his life ran across the border because the military put out a word that he had basically debriefed with the military, so.
So you sat through most of the trial. Mm-hmm. Were you convinced that Marciano Milan Vasquez was a Zeta high-ranking lieutenant?
If you look at him, but just by looks, no. I mean, but from just looking at the witnesses, it was very, very convincing. I mean, they told of, he had this persona of being basically very, very ruthless and violent. So to me, it seemed, convincing. Their stories seemed very, very convincing.
Jason Book, describe what these acts. I mean, what did he do?
Well, first and foremost, he was a drug trafficker. That was how they made their money. Was bringing, they said, tons of drugs across the border into Texas. I think a lot of it was going to San Antonio and Austin. And we're talking about marijuana, cocaine, and methamphetamine. There was one multi-kilo seizure of methamphetamine that. I think the street value would have been in excess of $1 million. And that was just one of, I think, 18 seizures that the prosecution said they were able to tie to Milan Vasquez. And one witness testified that he would lose, I think it was a single-digit percentage. This was another drug trafficker who was testifying about Milan Vasquez, talking about his own drug business, saying he would lose, I think, single digits to percentage-wise to law enforcement. So what the amount of money that the Zetas were moving in conjunction with Milan Vasquez was far, far greater than the amount that the federal government was able to show they'd taken from them in this trial.
So it's almost inconsequential how much drugs are lost to seizures that they're moving into the United States.
That was certainly what the testimony seemed to present over the last couple of weeks in San Antonio.
Okay. Right. Okay. But these murders, mass murders, dozens of people rounded up and killed at a single time. I mean, talk about that. Why were they – what was the point of that? I mean, why kill so many people?
I think Guillermo can talk more about what we saw because what sort of the horrific acts that were described. He was in court for a lot of that testimony. I can say that the goal of this was to intimidate, was to exercise absolute control over what they call the plaza, the region around Piedras Negras that the government said Milan Vasquez was the they called him the plaza boss. He was the regional leader. And so in order to maintain their control over the region. They executed people who were they believed were associated with informants, people who they believed had helped out rival cartels, government officials that were not willing to play ball with them. That was the goal of this. But, I mean, I think some of the testimony that Guillermo sat in on showed just how far they were willing to go.
So Guillermo, so Milan Vasquez, he was the cacique of that area.
Well, he was up on, in 2013 is when he assumed control as an actual lieutenant. But he was essentially doing the leader's bidding before that, is what the trial showed. And when you talk about these people, we're talking more than 300 is what the witnesses said, were picked up. It's known as the Allende Massacre, named for a town south of Piedras Negras. And Piedras Negras is a border town that borders Eagle Pass. So it was essentially what the witness described as the leaders of the Zetas at that time were upset and feared that a high-ranking official named Poncho Cuellar with the Zetas had come over to the U.S. side and become an informant for the U.S. government. So the testimony that was described is that texts were sent basically saying, or orders were sent to the soldiers down there, the Zeta soldiers, and said, pick up anybody who has any kind of association with this guy, Poncho Cuellar. Pick him up. And essentially that's what they did. And then by picking him up, some of these people were, you know, they were kidnapped off the street in Allende and some of these other rural towns and questioned. There was evidence that they were questioned at some point. Some were, shot specifically in the head after. And we had, there were children among them. Some of these, the witnesses testified, had nothing to do with drug trafficking. One, for instance, was a teacher from Allende who just happened to know Poncho Cuellar, the turncoat. So it was basically a way of the government, the Zetas sending a message that, you know, they're not fooling around.
So this is a reign of terror.
Right. That's exactly what it was.
And but it wasn't just murders, that's enough, and kidnappings and drug running, but also this the scope of the corruption and the bribes that were given to high-ranking officials in Mexico. Guillermo, tell me about that.
Well, there are two witnesses that testified about that. One testified that there were at least two bribes delivered to minions for the former governor of Coahuila, about at least $2 million. I think it was at least a couple of.
And also the current governor, who is the brother of the former governor.
Right. There was the last witness. One of the last witnesses for government said it was a Suburban full of cash that was delivered to a ranch as a campaign contribution for the current governor.
All right, we're going to talk more about the Zetas, how they operate, military precision, how they move their drugs across the border, evade detection from U.S. law enforcement, and what the future holds for the Zetas. This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. It took a jury just 3 hours to find Marciano Milan Vasquez guilty of dozens of murders, running drugs, kidnappings, and other brutal crimes. Vasquez was a top lieutenant in the Zeta drug cartel, the most brutal and bloodthirsty of all the cartels in Mexico, when he was arrested while living here in San Antonio. We're talking about the trial and the Zetas and the future of this drug organization and drug operations in Mexico. We're joined by Jason Book of the San Antonio Express News, staff reporter, and Guillermo Contreras. He is a senior reporter at the Express News. So, Jason, let's talk a little bit more about this corruption. We just heard how they were giving millions and millions of dollars to the governor of Coahuila, the state there, and that was just how they did business. It basically gave them a giant, never-expiring, get-out-of-jail-free card. But how far does that corruption go?
Well, right. What the prosecutor said was this is how they were able to exercise that degree of control in the northern Mexico region, in the state of Coahuila, that they were able to conduct these mass kidnappings and mass killings and actually use the state jails as bases of operation because they had bought their way into control of them. There was a witness, as Guillermo mentioned, who testified that bribes were paid to former Coahuila Governor Humberto Moreira. And this was the first time that a witness had pointed to Moreira by name. The Justice Department has sort of been circling him for the last few years. They indicted the former treasurer of Coahuila, Hector Javier Villarreal, who pleaded guilty in San Antonio a couple years ago to financial crimes. They indicted the interim governor who served after Moreira's term in office. He's a fugitive in Mexico. They've indicted businessmen that they said were involved in schemes to launder bribes paid to government officials in Coahuila. And they have filed a civil asset forfeiture to try to seize a house in the Stone Oak area owned by Humberto Moreira's wife, mother-in-law. And what the U.S. government has alleged prior to this is that tens of millions of dollars in bribe money paid to government officials in Coahuila was laundered here in San Antonio. A week before last, on the first day of testimony and trial, we actually heard for the first time someone say Moreira's name and say that the Zetas paid money to Moreira. And it wasn't limited to protection, according to what this witness said. The Zetas actually used their influence with the government to get involved in coal mining, to get involved in a massive public works campaign that the state was running that actually ended up leaving the state $3 billion in debt. So the Zetas were able to get government contracts doing that, and they were able to get the permits that they needed for construction projects that they were doing to launder their money. Those were the allegations. Moreira has responded. He after the testimony, he pointed out that the witness who testified against him or about him had several years ago appeared in a, while he was apparently an informant for the U.S. government, had appeared on a Spanish language television show that was sort of a Judge Judy knockoff type show. And then he went on to criticize any connection that he has to the Zetas because several years ago his son was murdered in the border town of Ciudad Acuña. And Moreira has said that his son was killed by the Zetas. That's actually what the same witness testified to, that Moreira's son was killed by the Zetas. And Moreira said, stop trying to connect me to the people who killed my son.
Our phone lines are open. If you've got a question or a comment about the Zetas and the drug cartels in Mexico, 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Another revelation that came from the coverage of this trial here in San Antonio at the federal courthouse was that the Zetas were recruiting high school students from Eagle Pass to become part of their organization. And these are American kids in American high school, and now they're joining the Zetas. So, Guillermo, talk about that.
Well, one witness who was kind of running a lot of these kids testified that his mom got him into the drug business. You know, he started doing stuff, and he started making a name for himself, and the Zetas started to recognize that, started to recognize their usefulness, how they are able to essentially, they don't get much time in Texas. They're not held for very long. So the Zetas started recognizing this. They're a valuable
asset. Because
they're juveniles. The system is different for the juveniles. The feds don't like to prosecute juveniles.
What were they being tasked to do?
A lot of it was basically finding people to do pickups on loads, delivering. It was mostly delivering and pickups of drugs. So sometimes this particular witness would coordinate a load getting across, and he'd have some other juvenile, people he knew in high school, even from elementary, that he was recruiting into the group, saying, "Hey, can you do this job? Pick up 20 kilos of marijuana here." Do a pickup, they would deliver it to a certain point, a restaurant, whatever, and somebody else would pick it up, another juvenile, and they'd take it on to a different point within the United States. So it was this group of, I think he mentioned at one point, he had 80 juveniles working under him or for him or for the Zetas.
And these kids are making, thousands of dollars doing these things?
Yeah, I mean, it was in the low thousands, and he said, obviously this kid paid whoever he recruited a little less, so he can profit a little bit himself. So he was learning the business as he went along.
Did any of these high school kids from Eagle Pass, if you mess up with the Zetas, you pay a heavy price. You can be killed. Did anything like that happen?
Well, he didn't mention that was a case, but I know that he himself, after testifying, was very afraid for his life, and I'm sure that the federal government has moved him into a kind of a protective custody status because what we learned from people who did, adults, and the Zetas didn't care. If you were an adult working for them, you screwed up, or if you were a kid and they believed you were with a rival cartel, a spy, They would pick you up, they'd shoot you, they'd cut you up into pieces, and they'd burn you in barrels or dissolve your body in acid, is what we heard during the trial.
So Jason Book, you talk about the military precision of the Zetas, that this was an organization that was really, it was not a sloppy organization. Is that true?
One of the witnesses described the very complicated methods, precise is the correct word, ways they would bring drugs across the border several times a week. And I think it was probably the same witness Guillermo was talking about. He's 21 now. He started when he was 13 as a lookout for the gang. And he described how he would stand on the Mexican side of the riverbanks with his supervisor next to him. And he would be on the phone with all the moving parts of this operation. So there would be mules who were tasked with... People who he referred to as mules, who were tasked with moving the bales of marijuana across the river. So he would direct them to go...
So they're floating the drugs across the Rio Grande little rafts.
Well, actually, he said that the bales of marijuana themselves were buoyant enough that they would just lay across them and swim across while laying on top of the bales. And they would get across the river, and then they would just start walking toward a point that had been pre-designated. There was no one waiting at that point yet, but they would start moving to a pre-designated drop-off point. Meanwhile, he would have people on the Mexican side watching with binoculars, looking out for Border Patrol, as well as lookouts on the U.S. side trying to keep an eye out for law enforcement. There would be a pickup person waiting at another location, and that person was not allowed to go to the pickup point until he gave them the okay, until the mules reached the pickup point. And at that point, the person in a vehicle would go pick up the drugs. Then that person would go to, like, a big box store, like a strip center with a big parking lot, and leave the vehicle there, because that was the person most likely to get caught, and they didn't want that person to know where the stash house was. So they would leave the drugs somewhere public, and then someone who was trustworthy enough to know where the stash house was would come get the drugs and take them to the stash house.
And how frequently would they pull off an operation like this?
I believe he said several times a week.
So it was just like a regular thing. It was like a job.
Yes, you know? And this was just one. You could almost divide the cartel into a bunch of franchises or divisions. Just the Piedras Negras branch of the cartel was divided into, you know, there would have been several supervisors that would have had kids like this working for them.
In the trial, the testimony talked about that there were news kids that sell newspapers on a street corner, that they were rounded up and they were executed. Why were these kids killed?
These are paper boys. They're standing in the street, and the cartel believed they were lookouts for other cartels.
Like Falcons?
Yeah, like Halcones. That's essentially what was said by the witness, that they thought, these are kids. When you talk about youth, you're talking about, you know, between 10 and 17 years old, these kids that sell newspapers on the street. So he personally saw, described about 7 of them get killed. That way, shot, dismembered.
Brutal. Yeah. All right, and just on a suspicion that this was going on.
Right.
Okay, we're going to go to caller on the air. Ralph is on the line. Hi, Ralph. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that unknowingly I have met some of these people that are just bringing the drugs over, and they are targeting not the west side or the east side. They're targeting the north side. They're targeting young Anglo people from Brazil and Honduras and college students and high school students to distribute their drugs for them here in the city. It isn't transient. It's here.
Okay.
Believe me, they are here.
All right, Ralph, thank you for the call. Appreciate your insight. So Jason Book, does that jive with your knowledge?
I haven't heard that here in San Antonio, but it's not surprising. Our correspondent in the Rio Grande Valley, Aaron Nelson, a couple years ago had a story about a case that involved college students in Corpus Christi who were recruited. I think they were all in the same fraternity. And they were recruited and they were being sent down to pick up immigrants who had been led through the brush around the I don't remember if it was the Falfurrias checkpoint or the other one on the way to Brownsville. Was it Santa Rita?
Sarita.
These kids.
So they will recruit kids, adults, young adults, people who you don't look like a drug runner.
Exactly.
And so you may fit. So was this an eye-opening experience? I mean, Guillermo, you're a veteran of the federal courts. You've covered a lot of trials. But was this one especially eye-opening for you?
Well, it was eye-opening in the sense that, you know, the nature of the violence that came out in testimony was, you know, was horrendous. I mean, personally, I mean, I have a 4-year-old girl. So when I heard a testimony of a 6-year-old girl getting chopped up, I mean, that was...
In front of the parents.
In front of the parents, you know, and the parents made to look. They couldn't look away. I mean, that just drove it home. But on a larger sense, it kind of brought together a lot of these cases that don't make sense. Or you hear about, here's a group of kids or not kids, you know, college students. They could be grandmas charged with being straw purchasers of guns. Now you see the connection. Okay, they are working for somebody who, in essence, is getting the Setas guns or the cartel's guns. So you see it's connected throughout Texas. I mean, it's not just you look at the problem, it's not just on the border. It's in Texas. I mean, you've got the drugs, you've got the guns, you've got the money. You know, so you see all that stuff. And that, in a sense, I guess made it open my eyes in terms of how things are connected.
And Jason, I know you've been around covering the border and you've seen a lot of stuff too. What was this? Did this open your eyes or anything?
I really think it pulled back the curtain on a lot of what we've been hearing sort of trickle out in blogs and in rumors about what happened over the last few years in northern Mexico.
Plenty of things to follow up?
Yes, for sure.
All right, we'll be watching both your bylines and the San Antonio Express News in the future months. There's a lot of stuff here to check up, follow up on. We want to read about all of those things. Jason Book, staff reporter for the Express News. Guillermo Contreras, senior reporter at the San Antonio Express News. We appreciate both you guys coming in today. And when we come back from the NPR news break, we're going to continue our discussion about the Zetas. We talk with experts about what's the future of the Zetas and the drug cartels in Mexico. This is The Source on KSTX. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're continuing our conversation about Los Zetas. That is a Mexican criminal syndicate considered by the U.S. government to be the most technologically advanced, sophisticated, vicious, ruthless, violent, and dangerous cartel operating in Mexico, and their reach extends far into San Antonio. We spent the first half hour speaking about the recent trial that wrapped up in San Antonio, where one of their leading henchmen was convicted of multiple murders, kidnappings, and running of drugs and other terrible. But now we're going to talk about take a broader view of the Zetas and the drug cartels and the grip they have in Mexico and whether or not there is any change in the foreseeable future about that. Give us a call if you got a question or a comment. The number is 210-614-8980. We're joined by Nathan Jones. He's a professor of security studies at Sam Houston State. He's a non-resident scholar at the James Baker Institute at Rice University, and he's the author of the book Mexico's Illicit Drug Network and the State Reaction. And Mr. Jones, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us in the studio, Gary Hale. He's a former chief of intelligence for the Houston Field Division of the DEA covering the border. He's now a drug policy fellow at the James Baker Institute at Rice University. And Mr. Hale, hi, welcome to The Source. Thanks for being here.
Good afternoon.
So Nathan Jones, you've written this book about Mexico's illicit drug networks. And you heard our first half hour, and we've heard about how extensive and highly disciplined the Zetas are in delivering their drugs and making this product and finding their profits. What is it that we don't understand about the Zetas right now? Are we overestimating their abilities, or are we underestimating their abilities?
I would say a little of both. I'm not sure I would say that they're the most powerful cartel in Mexico. I would still give that to the Sinaloa cartel, and many are pointing to the CJNG, the Cartel de Jalisco Nueva Generación, as being one of the only groups that's rapidly expanding left. But they are very sophisticated. One of the things that's been missing from this conversation is their origin, which is they started out as a unit of Mexican special forces that were recruited by the then head of the Gulf Cartel in the late 1990s to be a personal bodyguard force. And they evolved from the armed wing of the Gulf Cartel into their own cartel. And they were with the Gulf Cartel for a long time. Their formal split happened somewhere 2007, 2010. And then they rapidly geographically expanded. And that's one of the really impressive things about the CETAs.
Gary Hale with the DEA, you heard what we the first half hour and what we were talking about, and you say that's nothing. That this is that's just the way the drug business is in Mexico.
Yes, that's true. It was interesting to hear the correspondents that were here earlier describing all of the testimony that they heard, and it seems appalling. But unfortunately, this has been going on for some time, and it's not. Only the Zeta organization that is involved in this type of criminality in Mexico, but other cartels. The level of violence that is perpetrated on not only other criminals but innocent civilians is beyond imagination. As a former DEA intelligence analyst and chief of intelligence for DEA Houston, we targeted the Zetas because they operate right on the border. So we had a number of capabilities, including informants and wiretaps and undercovers and other sources and methods that gave us great insight into the organization. So this the description of everything that came out in this trial, unfortunately, has been going on for some time and is rampant and widespread among criminal organizations in Mexico.
We're going to go to the phone lines. Number is 210-614-8980 if you want to call in and join the conversation. Maria is on the line. Maria, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello. Actually, it's Marie Isabel, but it's okay. Listen, my concern is why is it that there's certain people seem to forget the principle of supply and demand? If we were such an upright country of the rule of law, why are we as citizens not living up to that title, and why are we indulging in illicit drug use? That's my question. And if I think if we became this, the citizens were claimed to be, Mexico and the rest of the other cartel companies wouldn't have any business, and it goes elsewhere.
Okay, Maria, thank you so much. Let me ask you, Nathan Jones, about that question. She says it's the drugs. It's the money. Follow the money.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and this is the classic counterargument to prohibition. And, you know, countless academics, you know, have made this argument. And, you know, academics have been making this argument, you know, since time immemorial, but certainly going back to alcohol prohibition, you know, in the 1920s. This is one of the key issues. And while I'm sympathetic to the argument, I do also want to point out, and Gary can go into this in even more detail, the CETAs are one of the first cartels to truly diversify beyond drugs. So full legalization of, say, all drugs overnight might deny significant profits to a group like Los Zetas, they won't roll over and die in a day because they are involved in local extortion. They have laundered a lot of their money. They are involved in prostitution, human trafficking, myriad other criminal activities such that they won't just disappear overnight. So they are highly diversified. That's not to say that changing the prohibition regime wouldn't deny them significant profits, which allow them to capitalize other crimes. And so that's important to remember.
Right, but Marnie also brought up the fact that, you know, we're consuming the drugs here in the United States, and so we have some sort of responsibility since they're selling the drugs here. Mm-hmm. They're committing these horrible acts up and down the supply chain. So there's some sort of responsibility here.
Yeah, and this is an argument that has been made that there's a moral responsibility in terms of the consumer countries.
Now, I don't mean that as a country, but as individuals who decide that they're going to use drugs.
Well, yeah. I mean, and that argument has definitely been made by countless scholars. The argument sometimes gets made that if only people knew that the drugs they were using lead to death and violence in Mexico, they would just stop using drugs. And I think that's absolutely naive. People are, you, you, addiction can be viewed as a disease. Basically, that argument amounts to just say no. If that worked, we would have ended the drug war in the 1980s with Nancy Reagan public service announcements. It's a very complex problem. Legalization or regulation may be one of the ways out of it. But as I said before, they won't just roll over and die. They're highly diversified. Absolutely, there is some moral implication of being the largest consumer nation and therefore feeding an illicit market. Also, mind you, cocaine goes for a very high price in Europe. And so we are not the only consumers. There's a expanding global demand as well. Though in the Western Hemisphere, certainly we bear a large brunt of the responsibility in terms of consumption.
We're talking about the drug cartels, the Zetas. Here on The Source, we invite you into the conversation, 210-614-8980. We'll be right back after this one-minute break. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about Los Zetas, a Mexican criminal syndicate operating right across the border and sometimes into here in Texas, responsible for horrible acts, including beheadings, mass murder, indiscriminate slaughter of individuals, huge bribery acts, millions and millions of dollars that we know going to high-ranking officials in Mexico. And so what to do about that? How is it impacting us here in Texas, here in South Texas? We're joined by Nathan Jones. He has written the book, Mexico, Illicit Drug Networks and the State Reaction. And also we're joined by Gary Hale, and he's a former chief of intelligence for the Houston Field Division of the DEA. They're both with the Baker Institute at Rice University. But Gary Hale, we've heard about all these terrible things that the Zetas and other drug cartels are doing. And they sound like ISIS to me, like some of these horrible beheadings and stuff. I mean, why don't we consider them just outright terrorist organizations?
There has been, interesting that you mentioned that, there has been previous discussion towards designating the Mexican drug cartels or transcriminal organizations as foreign terrorist organizations. Representative McCall from Houston is one of the proponents of doing that. Now, there's a it's an interesting argument, and it's a double-edged sword. Why? If you designate any organization, let's call it a Mexican cartel, let's call it the Sinaloa cartel, as a foreign terrorist organization, that makes that organization an enemy combatant, okay? Then that allows the United States to do whatever it needs to do to kill that.
Like send drones into Mexico?
Like send drones into Mexico and kill, Chapo Guzman if he was so designated by law as a foreign terrorist organization or the head of one. That's how the United States went into Pakistan to kill Osama bin Laden. It was an extraterritorial incursion into a third country from a second country, Afghanistan, without the permission of that country because we did it under that law, the foreign terrorist organization designation and law that allows you to kill an enemy combatant. So if Mexican cartels, the Zetas, the Sinaloa cartel, whoever, was to be designated as such by the U.S. Congress, that changes everything. And I don't think it's a good idea because of what is at stake between the relationship between the United States and Mexico. There's so much involved in regards to immigration, the economy, public safety, and a number of other issues in the bilateral relationship that it probably wouldn't be a good idea to do that. But there are some in the United States government who are looking at that.
Nathan Jones, I mean, the Zetas or drug cartels, they're not they don't have a political agenda other than they just want to make their money. So is that enough to say that we shouldn't consider them terrorist organizations?
Well, yeah, I would say that that's the main point, is these groups are profit seekers. Insofar as they have a political agenda, it's about, politicians they think they can corrupt, the ones that are already in one particular group's pocket versus another. There are a lot of metaphors in political science related to the relationship between organized crime and the state. Is it parasitic? Is it state capture? Have they captured the state? Things along those lines. But generally, I think you hit it right on the money. It's about they don't necessarily have a political agenda. They have a profit agenda.
So your book, Mexico's Illicit Drug Networks and the State Reaction, some people have accused Mexico of actually being complicit in doing the drug cartel's bidding. It brings billions of dollars into their economy. Is that the case?
I don't think it's that simple. It used to be a lot easier to draw straight lines between government officials and, Mexican government agencies, for example, the Dirección Federal de Seguridad, their version of the FBI in the 1980s, was, clearly had a direct hand in the drug business, in many ways controlling it. That all got broken up after the murder of the heroic American DEA agent, Enrique Camarena. And he was murdered, in broad daylight. Well, he was kidnapped in broad daylight and tortured and murdered. And that broke up that institution. Since then, you've had kind of this alphabet soup of Mexican law enforcement agencies. And a lot of academics are now looking at it and saying, well, you had a breakup of the cartels in the 80s, and you had a breakup of the law enforcement agencies trying to control them in the 80s. And so you've seen this kind of paramilitarization in the 90s going forward. And I've said that in my book, and others have said that as well. And that's kind of how we've gotten to the situation that we've been in now. A lot of fragmentation on both sides.
But we heard about it in this trial, millions of dollars being given to the governors of Coahuila. What are they getting for that money? I mean, that's corruption.
Yeah, so they're getting the protection of the state. They're buying off the state, getting the state to look the other way. And it's happening at the level as high as the governors, which begs the question, does it happen even at higher levels within federal institutions on up to the highest levels? And so, yes, but the interesting thing is, they aren't unified, and nor is the state as unified as it once was in the 1980s. So it's very complicated, and that explains a lot of the violence.
You can say that the federal government and perhaps even some state governments have acquiesced to the wishes, the desires, the wants of the criminal elements in Mexico. They just look the other way. That's part of the corrupt act.
Is that because Peña Nieto's war on the cartels failed?
The jury is out. He certainly hasn't followed the same level of effort that the previous administrations under the opposing political party, the PAN, did, going back as far as Vicente Fox, and then to be followed by Calderón. They were very, very strongly confronting the cartels. The Peña Nieto administration under the PRI party is kind of taking a sideline view of what's happening. There is certainly a lot of confrontation between elements of the Mexican military, particularly the Navy, against cartel organizations or Mexican criminal organizations. But it doesn't seem to be a policy like it was in previous administrations.
So Nathan Jones, what about our national security? If Mexico is basically a de facto narco state, if the drug cartels can operate this way, isn't that a concern for us?
Well, certainly it's a concern. This gets into the debate about spillover violence. And you get different views, and there's a lot of political agenda around those views. Typically what you see is the cartels, knowing that law enforcement is effective in the United States and actually truly fearing it because of the deterrent effects we've set up by our strong response to the killing and the murder of Enrique Camarena, but going all the way back to the 1980s, they know that they have to abide by different rules on the U.S. side than they do in Mexico. And that's why you don't see open pitch battles in the United States, and you typically don't see the direct targeting of law enforcement by these groups in the United States, typically. So I want to caution that with typically the levels of violence are much different. So while it is a concern, there are rules of the game, and so we don't want to be too alarmist in terms of, saying things like, well, we've got to just shut down the border. Well, there's $500 billion in trade And the violence in those southern counties is actually lower than the interior average of the United States, according to a USA Today survey study that they did, and any reading of the Uniform Crime Report statistics. Now, Congressman McCaul has made a really good point, which is, hey, those uniform crime statistics don't take into account crimes like kidnapping, which can be used to settle up drug debts. So he makes a really good point that we may be missing some information, but in general, the data suggests that we don't have to go into a panic about spillover violence.
And so, Mr. Hale, what do you think about spillover violence? Is that a concern?
I did a lot of work on spillover while I was with DEA, particularly for the Obama transition team, because they wanted to get a handle on what was going on the U.S.-Mexico border. And we did find that there is a lot of what you would call spillover, and it goes both ways, where you've got Americans or American interests, American businesses, American citizens that are being victimized in Mexico, and then you've got any combination of American citizens, Mexican citizens, illegal aliens, resident aliens that are being victimized on the U.S. side.
So it doesn't have to be like right on the border. I mean, San Antonio is only 150 miles from the
border.
Right.
Well, yeah, that's what the area between, let's say, San Antonio, Texas, and Monterrey, Nuevo León, that's what I call the Palestine of the United States, because it's a whole other country. And in that country, you have a different culture. A common culture, a common language, common music, common food, common everything to the people that live here. And so, and you have this transparent border where people can go back and forth at will, generally at will, either legally or illegally. And that came up in this trial, as mentioned before. So these criminals are able to get over here, grab people, take them to the Mexican side, kill them, torture them, and vice versa, you know, where you can do it in Mexico, you can do it in the United States, and that is hurt, harm, or kill someone. And so the spillover generally is confined to this region. It doesn't really, you know, if a Zeta member is in Detroit and he kills somebody, that's not spillover. When we're talking about spillover, we're talking about the border. So it does occur, but when compared against all criminality, of course, if you're in Arizona, you're going to call me crazy because, hey, I'm being victimized. Or if you're in South Texas and you're being victimized, you're going to say, a spillover is terrible. But when you look at it from the larger optic, you know, 10,000-foot view, it is an issue, but not, in my estimation, a national security threat.
Gary Hale is former chief of intelligence for the Houston Field Division of the DEA, now a drug policy fellow at the Baker Institute at Rice University, also joined by Nathan Jones, professor of security studies at Sam Houston State and a scholar at the James Baker Institute. And this is The Source on KSTX. Thanks for tuning us in.